Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
Let's start the week off right. Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast. I'm your host, Catholic Answers apologist and speaker, Trent Horn. And man, have I been busy. Over the past weekend, I've traveled up to Los Angeles. I took the train up there, which, by the way, is a beautiful ride on the Pacific Surfliner. I highly recommend it. And you get to avoid that nasty California traffic. Gave a talk at Right to Life of Southern California. Then I flew over to South Carolina to give a talk at Our Lady of Grace Parish there in Lancaster on Hard Sayings, a Catholic approach to answering Bible difficulties. And then right after I finished that talk, I was able to order my tickets to this year's International San Diego Comic-Con. Big shout out to my friend Andrew for helping to make that possible for me to get them. Then got the tickets, hopped on the plane back here to California, and here I am in the studio where I can take a breather and record new episodes of the podcast for you here. So I'm very grateful for you all to allow that to happen. On today's episode, here's what I want to talk about. First, latter part of the episode, I want to do a debrief about my dialogue with John Loftus on miracles. I know a lot of you have been requesting for debriefs and wrap-ups on these dialogues, and I'm happy to do that. And I'm happy to do these dialogues, by the way. I'm so excited we've been able to do them. We're currently prepping right now for having Timothy Gordon to come into the studio to record my dialogues with him. Normally, I do these dialogues with people who are either not Catholic or people who are Catholic but disagree with the church on essential teachings, like the teaching on abortion, for example. But I felt it would be helpful to bring Tim down here to the studio to dialogue with him because a lot of people had asked me, hey, you should do a podcast on this thing that Timothy Gordon recently spoke about. And whatever it may be, people say you should do a podcast on X or on what this person believes. You hear this all the time. You go on the blogosphere or on podcasts. Someone will say something. Everybody else responds to it. But I believe what's helpful is that when possible, we should sit down with this other person and talk to them about it. That way we're not getting this kind of escalating war of he blogged this and I'm going to blog that, or he podcasted this and I'm going to podcast that. So whenever possible, I think it's good to bring people in. Now, it's not always feasible to do that. And I don't think that any time that you mention somebody or say something critical of another person, that means I'm going to invite them to come here to the studio and have a hour and a half long conversation with them. That's not always feasible or necessary. But I think when it's a substantial disagreement and it's one that can be addressed well in the form that I have here on the podcast, then I think it's worthwhile. So that's why I think it's great for Tim to come in and we can have a conversation about things that Catholics have been disagreeing about lately, namely the death penalty and feminism. And so I want to give a big shout out to our supporters, by the way, at TrenthornPodcast.com. It's your financial support of the podcast that allows me to pay for Tim's travel costs, to bring him down here to the studio so that we can do this. It allows the podcast to grow and to expand. It's really made it something wonderful. So I'm thankful for you, and to express my gratitude for those of you who are patrons, you get bonus content. You get early access to the dialogues. You'll get the Gordon dialogues 24 hours early. You get access to my talk that I gave at the Catholic Answers Conference this year, Protestant Distortions of the Church Fathers. That talk is not available to anybody right now. It's just available to my patrons at TrenthornPodcast.com, as well as the study series we've been doing. Lots of great stuff. So consider supporting the podcast for as little, it's just $5 a month. You get access to the bonus content, and we get more and more people on board. That allows us to grow and expand and bring in more guests so we can have these important dialogues and so that I can edify you and build you up to become the next generation of evangelists and apologists who are defending the faith, which is really under attack. And that's what we're going to talk about today in the first part of the episode, is our faith is literally under attack by those who would like to see it, frankly, go out of existence or to not be the same faith that has been deposited by the apostles. So I want to talk to you about one news item. On October 10th, CNN hosted an LGBTQ equality town hall. So the candidates for the Democratic nomination for president were there. And one of them, so I'm going to talk about what Beto O'Rourke said. So Beto, his chances of getting the nomination are now approaching negligible, is what I would say. He's not, you know, I'm not going to say never, because as we've seen with politics recently, it can be very surprising who ends up being a nominee or a candidate for president. But I will say Beto's support has really plummeted in previous months. And so I think that that has motivated him to want to just go for full out no holds bar. I'm just going to say the most controversial things that I think are going to whip up the far left base of the Democratic Party. I know not recently he said, hell yes, we're going to take your AR-15s and AK-47s. I'm Beto O'Rourke. Did I just swear? Hell yes, I did. Watch online, by the way, Jimmy Fallon does a spot on Beto O'Rourke impersonation. I'm Beto O'Rourke and I'm running for president because I just love running. I ran here to the studio right now. I don't have a dishonest bone in my body. I don't have any bones in my body. I'm like those wacky inflatable guys at the car dealership. Jimmy Fallon, Beto O'Rourke impersonation. Definitely look it up. So that's funny, but what's not funny is what O'Rourke said at the town hall. I want to play that clip, this interaction with him and moderator CNN's Don Lemon, and I want to talk about it.
This is from your LGBTQ plan, and here's what you write. This is a quote. Freedom of religion is a fundamental right, but it should not be used to discriminate. Do you think religious institutions like colleges, churches, charities, should they lose their tax-exempt status if they oppose same-sex marriage?
Yes. There can be no reward, no benefit, no tax break for anyone or any institution, any organization in America that denies the full human rights and the full civil rights of every single one of us. And so as president.
And so I am going to revoke the tax exempt status of plant. Imagine at a CNN town hall, are you going to revoke the tax exempt status of Planned Parenthood's 501c3 division? I'm sure Planned Parenthood, they have a political action committee, but I'm sure they also have a way to make tax deductible donations because they're, you know, women's healthcare, quote unquote. I don't call it healthcare. Half the people involved end up dying, frankly. Imagine if a conservative candidate said, hell yes, we're going to take away their tax exempt status. They can barely get by with saying that the government's not going to fund Planned Parenthood anymore. But notice what's insidious here, that it's not the idea that these people are going out and oppressing others, that the mere existence of a church or a synagogue or a mosque where there are particular religious rules that people live by, i.e., you can't get married if you are still in a valid marriage or if you are attempting to marry a man or a woman, that these are rules that God gave us as part of the deposit of faith that we believe and are willing to die for our faith, that you, if you want to allegedly marry another person, whether it is a remarriage of a marriage that has been divorced but not annulled. So this would essentially be a case of bigamy because, you know, in Mark 10:11, Jesus is clear. He said anyone who divorces his wife and marries another woman commits adultery against her. Whatever it may be, that the mere existence of your religious organization that believes that and operates in that way, that can't be tolerated. And so you lose your tax-exempt status. This also shows why churches and religious organizations must be tax exempt, not just because, like other tax exempt organizations, they provide a valuable public service. You'll hear atheists say that the only organizations that should be tax exempt are those that are charities that are full-time charities and only do charitable work. But tax exemption applies to a wide variety of organizations that serve the common good, not just charities. You have social clubs, sports leagues, museums. I mean, look, if the postmodern art museum that thinks that a random tire on the ground is art can get tax-exempt status, and you think that that's silly, why can't religions have tax-exempt status if you think that they're equally silly? Now, of course, I believe that the Catholic faith is not silly, and so therefore, a fortiori, if the church, you know, if the postmodern art museum is allowed to, the contemporary museum of postmodern art, which includes things like a tire on the ground or a blank white canvas or all other kinds of garbage can have tax exempt status, then churches, which obviously are far better and serve the public good in a better way, should be able to retain that. Now, what I'm referring to, of course, when it comes to modern art, was when Laura and I, on our honeymoon, we went to Europe and we went to the Louvre, which is art from the ancient world of the 17th century, and then the Orsay, which is art from the 18th to the 19th century, which actually was, I like the Orsay better than the Louvre. I love Impressionist painters, Monet. I got a big kick out of that. That might be heresy for more of my high-minded friends, but I like the Orsay more than the Louvre. But they're both 1,000,000% better than Le Pompidou. Le Pompidou. So the Pompidou is where you get the postmodern art that is just absolutely terrible and doesn't understand aesthetic standards. But there's another argument beyond that, and that's this. In 1819, there was a Supreme Court case, McCulloch versus Maryland. So this is one of the earliest court cases in American jurisprudence. And Chief Justice John Marshall made an important observation. He said, "The power to tax involves the power to destroy, that the power to destroy may defeat and render useless the power to create." Now, this case wasn't about religion in general. I think it was about taxation involving steamboats, to my recollection. But McCulloch versus Maryland puts forward an important principle about taxation. The power to tax is the power to destroy. Government can destroy something. It doesn't have to outlaw it. It doesn't have to say you're going to be thrown in the gulags if you take part in it. Government can easily destroy something by just taxing the hell out of it. And then it's just not financially feasible and it doesn't exist anymore. So one of the principles that protects religious freedom, in order to have religious freedom, in order that the separation of church and state, which, by the way, that is a phrase that is not in the Constitution. Separation of church and state comes from a letter that Thomas Jefferson wrote to the Danbury Baptists, talking about how there should be that church and state ought to be separated. The idea of a wall of separation between church and state didn't come about until a Supreme Court case in the 1950s. But the point behind freedom of religion and the idea of separation in church and state by the founding fathers was not the idea that the church would take over the state and oppress everybody. It was the belief that the state would take over the church and drive it out of existence or radically change it so it wouldn't be the same church anymore. And that, when you look at court cases relating to freedom of religion, it's usually actors, state actors, who come in and try to impose secular or public values upon private minority religions and other religious groups. So that's why McCulloch versus Maryland, its principle, the power to tax, the power to destroy, is important here, that if you want to keep government, if religion has a right to exist and operate, and you want to protect it from government, you have to protect it from the main means government has to destroy it, which is the power of taxation. And so that's why it's important for churches to remain tax-exempt, that status. So something you can share with your atheist friend if they say churches ought, they should lose their tax-exempt status. No, they need that to protect them from the far more powerful state that can encroach on religious liberties. So be aware here. This is what people are trying to do. You know, Beto O'Rourke is at what, like 0.05% in the polls, but he got a lot of applause from that. There's a lot of people that hold that view. And so we have to be cognizant of it and where it is going. So this prompted Ben Shapiro to respond on his podcast talking about Beto O'Rourke, and that got a lot of play. Whenever I go on to Twitter, it's always funny. I see what's trending on Twitter. And when I see Ben Shapiro, I'm like, it's never going to be good news, because I'm sure about 85% of the people on Twitter hate Ben Shapiro, which makes sense because Twitter is not representative of our country. It's not representative. I think something like 20% of the country has a Twitter account, but only like 20% of those people do 80% of all of the tweets. So something like less than 5% of people in the country make up the vast majority of what's being said on Twitter. So it's just not representative of the country at large. That's why it's funny when I see Ben Shapiro or another conservative commenter trending on Twitter, I'll say, oh, what are they mad about this time? And here it's what Shapiro had to say in response to Beto O'Rourke. And I thought it was interesting to see people's counter response to him. So I'm gonna play that.
Church, you're not infringing on anybody's rights. You're just saying you can't come here for your marriage. Go to the church down the street. You're a religious school. You're saying, listen, you want to learn about gay rights? Go to the public school down the street. You're not infringing on anybody. Your mere existence is an infringement, according to Beto O'Rourke. The institutional existence is an infringement on liberty, according to Beto O'Rourke, and you must be shut down. You want a culture war in this country? You damn well have it, Beto O'Rourke. You want a culture war in this country? You want this country to come apart at the seams? This is how you do it. Because I promise you, if you come to tell me that you're going to indoctrinate my kids in particular policy, and that I can't pull my kid out of the school and send my kid to a school I want to send them to, that I can't go to the church or synagogue that I want to go to, and if you make that national policy, not just California policy where I can move, but national policy, people are not going to stand for that. They're not going to stand for that. And if you send a truant officer to remove my child, I have two choices at that point, right? If I have no place to move because you've now made this national federal policy, I now have two choices. One is to leave the country utterly. Two is to pick up a gun. Those are the only choices that you have left me. And now people on the left, oh, this is, how could you say stuff like that? How could you be so extreme? It's not extreme to defend the fundamental rights the Constitution was created in order to protect.
So first, this is an example that people often compare me to Ben Shapiro, and we do have similar thought lines on a lot of issues, and we're young, Jewish. I mean, he's fully Jewish. I'm only half Jewish. So, I mean, I guess people find the comparisons there. But where the comparison breaks down, I think, is the big thing here is Ben can just go a mile a minute when he speaks. I know some people listen to this podcast on 1.5 speed or 2x speed in order to get their day in. And when I listen to podcasts or great courses, I usually listen to them at 1.5 speed. But I wouldn't do that at Ben Shapiro. That'll go way too fast for me. But people... When I saw on Twitter, I saw like in the news feature for Twitter, it summarized what Shapiro said as basically saying, Shapiro says he will pick up a gun if LGBT education is included in schools. No, that's not what he said at all. The idea here is that imagine you want to teach your child basic truths about existence, about the human person. And you don't want them to be indoctrinated with perversions. You don't want them to be indoctrinated with falsehoods and lies. And also, maybe you think that government schools, and you would be correct on this, are inefficient, poorly run, and you could provide a better education for your child. And so you want to enroll them in a private religious school that offers a better education and aligns with your values. And maybe if you can't afford that, or you don't choose that option, you don't have that option available, you decide to homeschool your child. That should be your right to do that, to preserve the values you deem to be appropriate to hand them on to your children. People say, oh, you're just indoctrinating. Everybody indoctrinates. When children get sent to government schools, don't call them public schools. They're government schools run by a government monopoly intent on pushing particular values onto children. And they are, you know, they're inefficient, and they got a whole host of problems. But if you want to keep your kid out of that, you should have the right to be able to do that. And the state has tried to take that right away from us before. Back in the 1920s, the state of Oregon passed a compulsory law saying that all children had to be educated in government schools. Their point was they wanted to get rid of Catholic education because they considered Catholic schools to be un-American. This is back, you know, in the 1920s, 1930s, when the Ku Klux Klan was operating, and the Klan originally, the Ku Klux Klan, the KKK, was originally not going after African-Americans. Their targets were Catholics that they believed were bent on trying to start some kind of revolution. And so there were members of the KKK burning down Catholic churches, starting riots. They were originally an anti-Catholic organization. And there were people in government aligned with their views who wanted to close down Catholic schools and demand that all children go to public schools, government schools, which were basically Protestant schools, by the way. They would pray Protestant prayers. They would read from Protestant Bibles. And the Supreme Court, I think it was the Little Sisters case, Pierce versus Little Sisters in 1925. The Supreme Court took the side of Catholic parents and Catholic educators saying, no, the child is not the mere creature of the state. The child is not the mere creature of the state. That's what they said. And that line actually appears later in Pope Pius XI wrote an encyclical, Divini Illis Magistri, on the education of children. And he talks about the right that parents have because they are the primary educators of their children. And that Catholic, that papal encyclical from the late 1920s, maybe it's 1931, I don't think so. I think it's the late 1920s. Divini Illis Magistri quotes from the Supreme Court's case, from the Little Sisters case, that the child is not the mere creature of the state. But that's what we're seeing here, that we're seeing in our culture the idea that we're well beyond tolerance. Now it's celebrate or get out, that if you don't get with the program, you're going to have a serious problem on your hands. Even in the cases of hypotheticals, this is going on. It's much more drastic in Canada and the United Kingdom than it is in the United States right now, but it's coming. And so we have to be prepared for that. I want to point you to an incident that's going on in the UK right now. This is from the New York Times, October 3rd. The article says, he opposed using transgender clients' pronouns. It became a legal battle. The byline says, a British agency employee said a policy on pronouns went against his religious beliefs. A tribunal found his stance to be, quote, incompatible with human dignity. So So the case involves David McAreth, who worked for the Department for Work and Pensions. And of course, the New York Times, as you know, that it's of course, oh, the New York Times gets everything right, doesn't omit key or interesting facts of the case. They describe it and say that Dr. McAreth was undergoing training as a health and disabilities assessor for APM, a service provider for the Department of Work and Pensions in London, when another trainee asked how a transgender person should be referred to. Omar Ahmed, a senior employee, replied that transgender people should be addressed by their preference in line with the department's policy. But Dr. McAreth, who had briefly worked as a full-time evangelist, said that as a Christian, he could not use pronouns in that way in good conscience. So then it went to a British court to take the case that he was fired after that when he said, well, I'm a Christian. I can't use incorrect pronouns because that would be lying about another person. And that's what I've said here on this show, saying that now, the church doesn't have an explicit teaching on this, but I think a Catholic is well within his rights to say, look, I don't want to lie about people. And if I were to do this, if I were to refer to a man as she or a woman as he, that would be lying about that person, and I can't do that. Now, in this case, what the Times does not report was that this did not ever involve a actual individual person. Well, it may say it's a hypothetical, but it doesn't address a specific hypothetical. So one of McAreth's supervisors, James Owen, went to him and asked him this question. Now, how would you answer this question? You go, Eagles, and this is, oh, all right, Dr. McAreth, I have a question for you. He says, I'm sorry, we're in England, but that's a terrible British accent. Oh, I know that. I'm just trying to make it authentic here. I'm going to stop. So his supervisor comes in, asks him this question. If you have a man 6 feet tall with a beard who says he wants to be addressed as she and Mrs., would you do that? So what's interesting here is it's kind of weird that I don't know what he means by this, because if you say you have a man who is 6 foot tall with a beard who wants to be addressed as she and Mrs., would you do that? That's not a reference to a transgender individual, because transgender individuals are adamant that in this case, this would be a woman. This is a woman who is 6 foot tall with a beard that wants to be called she or Mrs. So Owen would get in trouble with the transgender people by saying, so if a man, 6 foot tall man with a beard came here, would you call him she? You know, would you call this person she? Because transgender people would say, that's not a man, that's a woman. It's ma'am. It is ma'am. I will give you a ma'am. You step outside. Look up GameSpot transgender woman, and you can see the video I'm talking about. I've referenced this earlier. That is a 6 foot unbearded man who is very angry at being called sir, and you could just see, and it's so hard for me to see that these are people who are hurting, whose souls have just been wounded so badly, and you can just see the pain, how they want to just, it's the same thing I see with radical pro-choice feminists who scream at my face when I'm doing talks or debates on abortion. I know 9 times out of 10, they are dying inside from a previous abortion decision they've made. And you can see a lot of people when they give into sin or disordered thinking or disordered lifestyles. A lot of us handle pain in different ways. Some of us handle pain by turning inward and hurting ourselves or being sad or depressed or lonely. But there's a lot of people, a large percentage of people in this country, in this world, who when they're hurting, they will turn into anger for relief, and that the pain goes away for them when they can be angry and lash out at other people. That's why it's so important when people are angry at you and you're sharing the faith with them to not take it personally. You know, sometimes God wants us to be a verbal punching bag for people. That's okay. 2 Corinthians 5:20 says, we are ambassadors for Christ, as if God were making an appeal through us. I urge you on behalf of Christ, be reconciled to God. We were ambassadors. I remember once watching a documentary about one time the U.S. Navy was reckless and one of their submarines accidentally sank a Japanese fishing trawler, a fishing ship. The submarine surfaced too quickly and it was being reckless and it killed a few Japanese students. So the American ambassador had to go to Japan for the funeral. And there were people yelling at him and screaming at him and crying. And he just took it all in great stride. I mean, it's not his fault. He wasn't on the submarine, but you know, he's an ambassador and he takes what for good and for ill. So if we're ambassadors for Christ, people are upset and angry. They're going to take out their anger at sin, their anger at their woundedness, or their anger at other Christians that have responded to them in an un-Christ-like way. They're going to take that out on us as well. So we have to be prepared for that and be rooted in prayer. That way we can absorb those verbal blows and get, you know, that anger and that blackness in their hearts out of them so that their hearts don't have to be hardened anymore and they can be open to God's grace. So I think that, so here's the thing with the tribunal. So with Makarith, this situation was brought to this British court. And what the court ruled is that Makarith said, look, I'm a Christian. And he cites Genesis 1:27. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. And so what the court said in its response, it said this. It said, belief in Genesis 1:27, lack of belief in transgenderism, and conscientious objection to transgenderism, in our judgment, are incompatible with human dignity and conflict with the fundamental rights of others, specifically here, transgender individuals. That boggles the mind to me, to say that one of the key texts in Scripture that is the reason that we have dignity, the reason that we are equal in dignity, is because in Genesis 1, 26-27, it says that God made man in his image. This is not the word here. The Hebrew word doesn't mean merely he to look like, image in the sense of, you know, sharing a physical resemblance. I think it's seluth and delum, whatever it may be. The Hebrew words here denote rather having a kind of royal reflection is the best thing that I can put forward as to get the idea behind what it means we made in the image and likeness of God in Genesis chapter 1. What this means is that we share the same value, the same standing with God because we're made in God's image. And this was radical at the time because in the time of Genesis, when Genesis was written, no one believed that all human beings were made in the image and likeness of God or the gods. Only the rulers were. So there was an ancient Mediterranean proverb at the time that said, the king is made in the image of God. The common man bears his shadow. So the proverbs and the thinking of the time was that the only people who bore the image and likeness of God were royalty, the kings. They're the ones who bore the image and likeness of God. The rest of us only have a faint shadow. We're not as valuable as the kings or the priestly class. And Genesis turns that on its head, says, no, all people, and not just all people, but men and women. That the translation is usually rendered, a rib is taken from Adam, but the original Hebrew word is more closely translated, side. Adam's side was taken from him, and from that was fashioned woman. So it's not his feet. Adam isn't above Eve. It's not taken from his foot. It's not taken from his head. Eve isn't above Adam. They are equals, and they form a complementary pair that finds, while they are equal and complete in and of themselves, because each is made in the image and likeness of God, when they come together, they can form one flesh and form a complementary union greater than themselves when they're apart. And that's why God says, be fruitful and multiply. Because in ancient Mesopotamia, the other prevailing thinking was that the common man is not made in the image and likeness of God, and that he is overpopulating the world and annoys the gods. The Epic of Atrahasis, from which the Epic of Gilgamesh is based on, you may have heard of the Epic of Gilgamesh, it has a flood that destroys the world. Well, look, that doesn't mean the Bible just directly copied and pasted an ancient story. The biblical author and the pagan authors are both describing a real event, a catastrophic flood, but they're ascribing different causes to it. The author of the Epic of Atrahasis said the gods flooded the world because human beings are noisy and they pollute the earth, and you know that they're noisy and they annoy the gods. And so that's why. Yahweh in Genesis puts forward the flood as a punishment for sin because God cares about people's holiness. He cares about holiness, which many of these pagan deities did not, and they were actually models of wicked behavior like child sacrifice, murder, incest, all kinds of terrible things. So that's the irony here you can point out, is that biblical texts that provide the foundation of our dignity are now said to be incompatible with human dignity. I mean, this is really up is down is up kind of behavior here. So this is also something that we'll see. It's going to make its way here. That's how it always happens. I mean, abortion was legal in Great Britain before it was ever legal here. It was made legal, I think, back in the 1960s. So Malcolm Potts was involved in that. I've debated Potts, you've heard before several times, at UC Berkeley. He, and now I think the main abortion provider over there is Marie Stopes, not Planned Parenthood really, but Marie Stopes, and they're, founds clinics there. And my point being is that a lot of these things that we see, including in Canada, the proposal, Jordan Peterson got famous because he vocally objected. He's not even Christian, and he vocally objected to the idea that he could be put in jail for using incorrect pronouns, or that the government could compel you to use certain kinds of speech, or else you could be censured. And part of this comes from the left's continuing idea that speech is violence. You'll say, sticks and stones can break my bones, or words will never hurt me. I've been to college campuses where students have told me words literally, and I'm using the word literally here correctly, words have literally the same effect as bullets on people. And so if bullets can kill people and words can kill people by causing them to commit suicide later, as if people have no free will, words should be restricted in the same way that guns are restricted. And it may go beyond that, by the way. One interesting item here that you see this happening in England, up is down is up. I thought this was a parody, and it is not a parody. This is from the Anglican Diocese of Rochester. This is a petition. This is a real petition they are sending in England. Because England's supposed to be like, oh, we should be more like in England. Like, they banned guns. They don't even have gun violence. And you Americans, you're crazy. You know, you have all this violence. Why can't you be like us? Well, violence has actually been increasing in England over the past few years. And it hasn't been gun violence, but it's been knife violence. That you ban guns, guess what? You can ban a lot of things. You're never going to, through the law, make man perfect. Because man is not made perfect by the law. That's the message of Christianity, is made perfect by grace. Law is a teacher. It teaches morality, but it's not the only thing we need to make us moral people. So even if you ban guns, you still have evil people stabbing each other. So the Diocese of Rochester has this petition. I will include the link to show you this is real. Government urged to restrict the sale of pointed knives. Leading experts on gang culture, county lines, and violent crime, as well as MPs, members of parliament, church and community leaders have used a conference on knife crime in Chatham to issue a call to government to ban the sale of pointed domestic knives. It says we should take measures here. The letter endorses research highlighted at the conference, which explains that the points on domestic knives are historic and no longer necessary. Historically, we needed a point on the end of our knife to pick up food because forks weren't invented. I'm going to stop. That's more Australian. Now we only need the point on open packets, and we can't be bothered to find the scissors. The idea here is that there are people in England that are so upset about knife crime, they want to ban pointy knives. We got to just ban everything. And it's important to ban things. You know, you could ban things that are definitely deleterious to the common good. I'm not somebody who thinks the Second Amendment requires people to be able to own nuclear weapons or something like that. But here, it's just past the point of silliness. And when I was reading this story, like, we've got to get rid of all the knives now, I couldn't help but think of this scene from The Simpsons. I forget which episode it's from. It's the one where Bart joins the Boy Scouts, or the analog to the Boy Scouts, and he joins them. He accidentally is signed up for the Boy Scouts, and it's run by Ned Flanders, and he hates it, but he sticks with it because if he goes through there, he's able to get a scouting knife. And at first he refuses. He's like, I'm not doing your stupid safety course. And then he goes out and he sees people using knives to like open presents and chase off people, and like everyone's using knives for stuff. And then he comes across Dr. Hilbert, and there's a guy whose appendix is about to burst.
Oh, this man's appendix is about to burst. Luckily, I have my trusty pocket knife. Stand back!
Thank you, Dr. Hibbert.
Don't thank me. Thank the knife.
Oh, seems like everywhere I look, people are enjoying knives.
My wife's always like, how do you have a Simpsons reference for every single thing that comes up in conversation? I say, well, it was a lot of not doing homework from the years 1997 to 2003. Thank you very much. So watching reruns of The Simpsons and all other kinds of good shows. And it all turned out just fine. But it's something that we need to consider. It's coming here. Before I close here, and I'm sorry, I know I promised I would get to the Loftus debrief. I will do that on Thursday. I think I'll talk about that on Thursday, and then we will get into some of the other topics that I want to discuss. I also do want to do a show talking about Bishop Barron's theology of hopeful universalism based on Hans Urs von Balthasar, because a lot of people have asked me about that. I am going to talk about that in the next episode this week, or possibly next week. We will get into that. But we're out of time. We're having too much fun. But let me leave you the news story to show that this is coming here, because the Supreme Court is discussing this from an article Tuesday, October 8th. In NBC News, the justices of the Supreme Court clashed over the meaning of sex in heated oral arguments on Tuesday for a blockbuster set of cases concerning the rights of LGBT workers. The court heard the cases of three LGBT employees, two gay men and a transgender woman, who claimed they were fired because of their identities. At issue was the meaning of Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, which forbids discrimination because of sex, but does not specifically refer to gender identity or sexual orientation. So the argument here is that sexual discrimination should also apply. Like, let's say you're a Catholic school and you fire a man who is married to another man. That's apparently sexual discrimination, because if that man were a woman who married a man, you wouldn't be discriminating. And that just goes completely beyond the bounds of what the Civil Rights Act was originally meant to pass, which dealt with blatant sexism, blatant racism. And you see a co-opting of good things, you know, ending illogical, bigoted, irrational discrimination, but then saying that there are no morally relevant differences between men and women whatsoever. And that is where we've gone cuckoo, up is down, down is up. And I'll cover this more as the Supreme Court gives its deliberation and ruling on these cases here probably in the next few months. So thank you guys for being with us today. I greatly appreciate it. Hope you enjoy it. Pray for our conversation with Tim Gordon, that it's very fruitful, and pray for the more episodes we have to come out that will build you up and edify you in your faith. You all have been great, and I hope you have a very blessed day.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrentHornPodcast.com.